and Festus is an engaging contrast. I mentioned it earlier, but I think that the contrast is that Felix is trembling about the judgment to come, and this pictures how the leaders of the world in the early harvest had the judgment still impending, still coming, and that they were less righteous, perhaps, than those that followed later, and that the ship of state, you know, changed after World War II, and the whole structure of political authority in old Europe and Christianity changed, and maybe for a little higher principle. Now, I don't say that the political leaders are really godly and following Christianity, but at least they have a concept for what is more appropriate and ethical than maybe that they did in times past. But in chapter 25, we have something similar to chapter 24. Chapter 24 says, after 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders, and we suggested that that five pictures the gospel age. Now at the end of that, we come to the harvest. Well, now when Festus came in, after 3 days, he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem. And then the high... that three just keeps coming up, and we have it on the other side of the board all the time. And it does pertain to the fact that we're still in an age of redemption, anyway. It's a symbolic number, though. And in verse 2... Well, let's just read a little bit from here. And let's see. Sister Marvy, could you pick up the thread and read from chapter 25, 1 through... Chapter through verse 8, 25:1-8.
3 days after arriving in the province.
Oh, Marvy, could I stop you just a moment? I'm sorry, there's a point I wanted to make from the verse before that. In chapter 24, verse 27, could you read that one verse first?
Okay. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison.
Okay. Now, this is actually a time marker for us. I don't think we have a time marker for Felix. I don't think he's in... I'm trying to remember, our research is into this. I don't think you can pinpoint Felix, but you can pinpoint Festus. And Festus comes into office. Well, I think at 58 A.D. Now, I don't know if we can tie it down real thoroughly, or whether it's a kind of a vague. But I have a marker in my Bible that says that's about 58 A.D. And so I think this is a marker by which you can go forward and backward in the timeline of Paul's experiences. That's all. Just this marker here. And
three days after arriving in the province, Festus went up to Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented the charges against Paul. They urgently requested Festus, as a favor to them, to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem, for they were preparing an ambush to kill him along the way.
Boy, that sounds familiar. And before that, it happened. Go ahead.
Festus answered, Paul is being held at Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of you leaders come with me and press charges against the man there, if he has done anything wrong. After spending 8 or 10 days with them, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day he convened the court and ordered that Paul be brought before him. When Paul appeared, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many serious charges against him, which they could not prove. Then Paul made his defense. I have done nothing wrong against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar.
Okay. So it is a pretty quick, pretty brief defense. He says, no, there's nothing to do. I haven't done really anything wrong. And he hadn't. He'd been in the temple area. Now, if I led to any confusion earlier, that is the Temple of Jerusalem, and it was the Temple of God. But he was very respectful of it, and he was accused falsely of trying to defile it by bringing in a Gentile into the temple. But he really hadn't done anything of consequence wrong. It was just his reputation that people couldn't stand, and so they reviled him with all these false charges. And I hope that we can feel the same way, that whatever persecution or reviling comes against us, it's false. Unless it be that we actually are trying to follow a godly life and they don't like that. That would be an accurate charge. I'd be happy to be guilty of that. but we should be circumspect in our conduct. Now, verse 9, Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered and said, well, will you go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me? And Paul said, I don't respect their judgment. And, well, he shouldn't. You've just heard all these ridiculous accusations that he knows are groundless, and you want to go there to be judged? And so he says, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know. And I think Festus really did pretty well know. And I think Felix pretty well knew that too. But, you know, they're political and they got to take care of things. You remember when Jesus stood before Pilate? He actually said, I find no guilt in this man. And even his wife, it says, you know, don't do anything against this man. I've suffered many things in a dream about this. And but as a politician, he had to deal with something. And he tried to get out of it by releasing somebody at the Passover. That wouldn't work. The crowd just insisted. So Paul here senses the same kind of spirit. And he says, no, I'll stay where the protection of law is. And I think we're thankful for the protection of law when things come up. And we're thankful that we have a just and orderly society, more or less, and that we can appeal to their protection. So let's go down to verse 11, and let's see, read through verse 17, 11 through 17. But let's see, Brother Tim, I don't think we've had your participation too much. Would you read those 11 through 17?
Sure. This is from the American Standard. Okay. If then I am a wrongdoer and I have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of these things is true, of which these men accused me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Then when Festus had conferred with his consul, he answered, you have appealed to Caesar, and to Caesar you shall go. Now when several days have elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and paid their respects to Festus. While they were spending many days there, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there is a man who was left as a prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him, asking for a sentence of commendations against him. How far?
17.
I answered them that it is not the custom of the Romans to hand over any man before the accused meets his accuser face to face and has the opportunity to make his defense against the charges. So after they have assembled here, I do not delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribune and offered the men to be brought before me.
Okay, so Felix Festus is telling Agrippa and Bernice a little history of what's going on here. Now, Agrippa had what position? Who was Agrippa? What was another name for
him?
The king. King. He was king. Now, where did Agrippa get his... Why was he installed as king? Does he have some family connections or something?
Bernice.
Bernice was his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What was another name for Agrippa?
Herod.
Herod Agrippa. He was part of the Herod family. He was part of that network. Now, I forget just now all the details with his grandson of Herod the Great. Maybe that was it, but he was part of that Herod network, and that's why he was involved in the kingship here. Now, as we go through the passage, we're going to see that Paul tells Herod, hey, Agrippa, says, I know you believe the prophets. I know you do. You've got this background. Now, you know, King Herod himself was Edomite, at least part Edomite, part Jewish, but he had come in and accepted the Jewish faith, sort of. You know, when Herod, I mean, the real Herod, I hate to use his official title. You know what it is? Herod the the great, you know, and I just don't like to say that. Is
you know,
the terrible.
Nobody answered that.
That's right. But you remember when Jesus, when the wise men came to Jerusalem, they said, "Where is he that is born King of the Jews?" And Herod said, "Well, let's find out," you know, and they went to the priest and so forth, and they said, "Well, the prophecies say he's going to be born in Bethlehem." So Herod said, "Okay, Bethlehem's the spot." You see, Herod, as wicked as he was, he had a certain belief, "Oh, yeah, it's right, you know, I don't like it all, but and the King of the Jews is going to be born according to prophecy?" He believed it. So let's kill him and be done with it. But talk about a corruption of faith. Well, you know, he believed it, so he got to dispose of it. Well, anyway, so this Agrippa apparently has some agreement with the fact that, yes, the Jewish concepts are right. And so he's a religious person in that respect. Now, his wife, his consort, I think would be a picture also of some other religious institution, which was kind of the consort. Now, Festus represents the political authority, and these other two are religious directed, and they're kind of compatible, but one's superior to the other. I mean, you know, one's the head of the other. One's the king, the other's the bride. Then, can we make any connection to our position later in the harvest? Remember, Felix is early in the harvest, now we get later in the harvest. Now, in Revelation, we talked about chapter 27, 28, the other side of the board, as showing us a lot about the latter part of the harvest. That's where most of Acts 27 is about. And we did come to a part where it talked about undergirding the ship and trying to hold it all together. Is there any movement late in the harvest that tries to hold things together because they're starting to fragment and pull apart? What does Revelation say just before Armageddon?
Well, three unclean spirits like frogs come together. The beast, the false prophet, and the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet.
That's it. And it's in that order. Now, I always say them in the wrong order, by the way. The beast, dragon, false prophet. But it is properly dragon first. And then the beast. And then the false prophet. As a matter of fact, these are also highlighted at the very end of the judgment, Revelation 19. The beast was taken, and the false prophet with him, they were thrown alive into the lake burning with fire. And now you got to deal with the third party of this triumvirate, the dragon, put a chain around him and put him in the pit and set a seal over him until the end. We have more use for him at the end. There's the three parties that are kind of the master of the Christian world. Now, I say the dragon is first, and that's because if you go to chapter 12, you'll find the great red dragon mentioned. And then in chapter 13, you'll find the beast, papacy, mentioned. And then after that, you come out of the earth, about halfway through chapter 13, there's the two-horned beast that rises up. And that effectively becomes the false prophet. How do we know that? Because it says of that two-horned beast, he wrought miracles and deceived those that dwelt on the earth. Now you go to chapter 19 at the end of the chapter, and it says that false prophet, you know, the one that wrought miracles and deceived those on the earth. Well, that's the two-horned beast. The false prophet is the two-horned beast. But now he's the false prophet because he's giving forth a false prophecy. What is that false prophecy, that false teaching? Well, if you go back to 1 Kings chapter 22, and, you know, sometimes I remember exactly where I learned something. It was the Palo Alto Convention, Brother Carl Hagensick speaker. I was a young man at the time, young boy at the time, and I listened with enraptured attention about his treatise on 1 Kings 22. And I was so taken by it. I'll tell you the story of 1 Kings 22 and show you how it ties in here. But afterwards, I talked to another brother that I guess didn't appreciate it quite so much. And I was so enthused about it, and he just thought it wasn't so good. Well, I remember another occasion I gave a talk. This was in Phoenix, and it was an old brother, Siglin, and I enjoyed him, and I have a lot of respect for him. But I gave a talk in something prophetic, and afterward, he wasn't too impressed by it. And I said, "Well, I think it sort of roughly fits." And he says, "You know what happens when you build a house roughly?" So I guess everybody's not impressed with all these connections. But in 1 Kings 22, you have a scene where King Ahab, he wants to go and have a military victory and retake something that was his that he lost. It's Ramoth-Gilead. He says, the Syrians have got it. It really belongs to us. Let's go take it. But he's not strong enough in himself. So he asks Jehoshaphat to come up to support him, and he needs the strength of the Jehoshaphat's armies to be with him. Jehoshaphat says, well, okay, all right. You got a prophet, to tell us about this? So he says, yeah, here's a prophet. And he comes out with this Zedekiah, the son of Canaanah, not the Zedekiah, the king. And this guy, it says, wears two horns. And he's got an entourage of 400 false prophets with him. And he says, go on up, and the Lord will give you the victory. Everything will be just fine. Well, I can't help but think, as Carl pointed out, you've got Ahab. You think about Ahab and Jezebel, the papal domain. Now, they need the support of the strength of Jehoshaphat's armies. There's civil power. There's like the dragon. Then to congeal all this, you'd have to find a prophet that's going to say, this is about right. So this false prophet says, sure, it'll be just fine. That's the false prophet. That's why, and he's got a pair of two horns on him, that's why it becomes the false prophet. He gives a false prophecy. And that is, you are God's people, he'll protect you, and you'll have the victory. Well, Jehoshaphat, he's a godly king, and he hears all this. And he says, is there a prophet of Jehovah that we could sort of check out with this? This other man's kind of with Baal, He says, well, yeah, there is one, His name is Micaiah, but he never says anything good about me. Jehoshaphat says, well, let's hear him out. Hear what he has to say. So they go get Micaiah, and they bring him out of prison. And the guy conducting him says, okay, Micaiah, you're going before the king. You better say something good here. He says, whatever the God tells me, that's what I'm going to say. So he goes before the king, and Ahab says, okay, Micaiah, tell us, what do you think about this coalition that we're proposing? Sure, go ahead. You'll be no problem. You'll be successful. And there was something about the tone of voice that told Ahab, this is serious. He says, no, come on, tell me what you really think. Tell me the truth. He says, okay, you want the truth? This is what I see. I see the sheep scattered upon the hills without a shepherd. That's what's going to happen. Well, who's the shepherd of Israel here? The king, Ahab. He's telling him, you go into battle, you're going to die. So Ahab turns to Joshua and says, see, what did I tell you? You never said anything. He says, take him back to prison, feed him with the bread of affliction, till I come back in peace. And that's where Micaiah says, if you come back at all, I'm no prophet. Ahab never came back from that battle whole. Ahab was shot, pierced with an arrow at random. Ahab, he took to heart what he heard. He says, well, I'll tell you what, Jehoshaphat, I'll go into battle disguised, and you be the leader here, Maybe we'll get out of the curse, And so Jehoshaphat put on his royal robes, and they went for Jehoshaphat. And when Jehoshaphat was in jeopardy, he prayed to God, save me, and the God saved him. Jehoshaphat escaped with his life. But at random, somebody just shot a bow and hit Ahab right between the joints of the harness. You're not going to get out of this, no matter what. And it pierced him, and he was wounded, and they took him away, and he took him to Jezreel, where the dogs washed out the chariot with his blood, just where Elijah has said, the dogs will lick your blood. So when God says something, it's going to happen. No way around it. In ancient times, there was actually a practice, irrespective of Israel, where they would see a bad omen, and, like an eclipse or something, and they said, that's a bad omen for the king. So they actually did this? They said, okay, we're going to have this pauper, or whatever it was, he's going to serve as king for the next week or two. They would elevate him, so the curse would fall on him. And then after that was out of the way, then the king come back to Pharaoh. So I guess Ahab tried to do everything he could to avoid this, but at random he was picked out and killed. And I think this is a picture of the fact that the beast, I shouldn't say that, the dragon, it's always in that order. My brother always corrects me there, and he's right. It always says, when it's listed, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. When the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet coalesce, because there's a weakness that they perceive. They need this common strength, each one of the other. They're weak. There are chairs, you're young and comfortable, but you do as you wish, but there are chairs. they're coming into coalition, and they need the strength of each other to support themselves, because society is pulling apart. That's what we see, the drying up of the river Euphrates, and now we've got tension, we've got difficulty, and I think that's where that 14 days of storm start coming in. And the first thing they do in Acts 27 is undergird the ship, try to hold this all together. Now, Sherelle, was it you that really gave me some good thoughts on those 3 days? I'd like to just revisit that. Maybe you said it already publicly, did you, or did we? Did you? Okay. Oh, yeah, I guess we got back to that. They try to protect, undergird the ship. The next day, they lighten the load, not concerned about the economy, the profit. They just want to save themselves. And the third, they throw out the tackling. They've given up on repairing the ship. They just went out with their life here. And I think those 3 days do connect with the 3 days of darkness. But this is the stresses on society. And they're undergirding of the ship, and they pass by Clauda, maybe trying to get control of the old power again by undergirding and strengthening. Maybe that's when the dragon, the beast, and false prophet coalition comes in. Well, Micaiah, when he tells them that this isn't going to work, he uses this. He says, I saw lifted up the throne of God, and I saw him say, okay, who's going to be a false spirit, a lying spirit, to go into the mouth of these false prophets to convince Ahab to do this coalition and be destroyed at this battle? This is a scene Micaiah projects. And one said on this occasion, another said on this occasion, and finally one came and says, I'll do it. I'll go be a lying spirit in the mouth of all these false prophets, and I'll congeal this coalition, and Ahab will meet his doom. And Micaiah says, that's what's going on up there, and that's what's going to happen here. Now you go to Revelation, and it says, as somebody mentioned, Gloria, three lying spirits like frogs out of the mouth of the beast, the dragon, and false prophet. And these congeal the coalition, but they're lying spirits. They're going to bring these three parties to Armageddon, and that's where they're going to fall. Now, I think, if it's correct that the powers of old Europe are going to coalesce with Gog. If Gomer is old Europe, and Gog is Russia, and then the other allies, Iran and Turkey and Libya, they come together and they advance against the Middle East. Now you have old Christendom against Israel. And now you've got what appears to be this coalition in 1 Kings 22. And what Revelation 16 says, these are going to lead you right to Armageddon, to the Battle of the Great Day. So they're all intertwined. They come on down, and that's where God is going to hold judgment over them. They will be vanquished. Israel will be delivered. So Ahab is going to die at this point, you know, the systems of Christendom. And so I think maybe, and this is very interpretive, of course, but maybe when Paul stands before these three, the king, the political ruler, Festus, and then King Agrippa, who really serves as king, you know, kind of secondarily to Festus, who's the Roman appointee. But Agrippa is religious, and his consort, you know, Bernice, maybe you've got the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. And that this is the last, latter part of the harvest when Micaiah comes out to give his thoughts. And so here's Paul to give his defense. So maybe that's the backdrop here. Now, with that general overview, I'm happy. Because Felix is first, he's more corrupt. Festus is better, he's later, it's later in the harvest, and you got this perspective and cleavage between the two. But to be honest, as you go through all the details, I don't know what to say, because I don't have all the details in focus. But I just think this overview is about right. But let's read through some more now and just see if some comments come to your mind or whether there's something we can say here. But because Paul has already appealed to Caesar. Now that was in chapter 25, verse 11. Whatever happens next is almost a moot point because he's already appealed to Caesar. And he's going to go to Caesar. But now Felix, Agrippa comes down with Bernice and they're going to have an audience. So see, how far did we read? Down to 17 before? I think so. Yeah. So let's go now 18 through 24. And let's see, Sherelle, would you read that for us?
The Revelation kind of follow you there.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So it's
Acts 25:18-24.
Acts 25:18. And when the accuser stood up, they began bringing charges against him, not of such crimes as I was expecting, but they simply had some points of disagreement with him about their own religion and about a certain dead man, Jesus, whom Paul asserted to be alive. And being at a loss how to investigate such matters, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there stand trial on these matters. But when Paul appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I send him to Caesar. And Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, he said, you shall hear him. And so on the next day, when Agrippa had come together with Bernice, amid great pomp, and had entered the auditorium accompanied by the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all you gentlemen here present with us, you beheld this man about whom all the people of the Jews appealed to me, both at Jerusalem and here, loudly declaring that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and since he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him.
You might as well finish it up.
Yet I have nothing definite about him to write to my Lord. Therefore I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the investigation has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems absurd to me in sending a prisoner not to indicate also the charges against him.
It does seem pretty. I have appealed to Caesar, now I want to see what's the problem here, you know? You know, it's interesting. Poor Festus, he's kind of in a spot. He's just a Roman person. He says something about a dead man, Jesus. He came to life. I don't know. Help me out here. You know, this whole thing is confusing. And it doesn't sound all right here. I don't know what to write on my charges, you know. So I can understand Festus's position here. So Agrippa has a little more knowledge about these things. And so that's the predicate for chapter 26. So I guess we have nothing to comment on here. Cheryl?
I actually had a question on just before this. We were talking about Festus, Agrippa, and Bernice all together.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if you said it just now or if you said it when we were talking last night or if I just misunderstood. But you were comparing Festus to the political,
yeah.
Agrippa to the papacy, and it was Bernice to the Protestant?
That's what I'm tentatively thinking, yes.
In that case, would the fact that Agrippa and Bernice were married to each other show any indication of their current trying to come into unity?
Compatibility. That's a very good point. I think that would be a reasonable way to put it. Now, we do see, since 1948, we've had the World Council of Churches. Interestingly, that's after World War II. Now, something that Sherelle mentioned in fellowship earlier was about Tyre, that for 70 years, Tyre would be forgotten. Well, we often have the thought that Babylon was cast off in 1878. That's kind of like when Israel was cast off before Jesus, you know, went to his death. And then 3.5 years after the Second Advent, Babylon is cast off, Christendom. And 70 years later, takes you to 1948, when the World Council of Churches begins. In my back of my mind, I've always thought, well, that 70 years is the 70 years when Tyre is forgotten, and then they sing as a harlot again. So here comes the old desire to have more prominence again. And now, you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union, who was the Pope at the time that all happened?
John Paul
from...
Poland.
You know, boy, what a victory for him. I mean, communism and Catholicism were at odds. And now it looks like the upper hand has come the other way. And now, I remember, when much younger, when Pope John the 23rd, before John Paul, says, the church seems fated to die. It's like almost a famous quote. But today, I don't think the Pope is going to say, seems that way. Things are looking up. And I think maybe they're coming back into their own a little bit. Now, I am not one that expects difficult persecution of the church in the future. I really think, more and more, that period of 1260 years is at an end. And in Revelation chapter 10, at the end of those days, you see an angel come down with a cloud and a bow. What does the bow represent after the flood of Noah's day? What's that?
Promise.
The promise. That trouble is over and will not be repeated. I think that bow in chapter 10 of Revelation is telling you the same thing. Those 1260 years are over. That kind of situation is not going to be repeated. Now, I know things are going to get difficult, but I just don't... My own opinion is, we do have the dragon, the beast, and false prophet coming together. We do. But I don't think that's going to be persecution unto death. I just don't see that. I do think, though, the Elijah class goes up in trouble and a whirlwind and a fire and difficulty. But I think that's the fire and difficulty incident to the closing experiences of the age rather than an overt persecution by an old papal institution revived. Even in Revelation 17, the ten horns come to power for 1 hour. But what do? They eat the Jezebel and they burn her with fire and they dispose of her. That's what happens. It's the ten horns. The ten horns are Gentile rulers. What are Gentile rulers pictured as? The Gentiles, rather. What are they pictured by? Dogs. And those are the dogs that ate Jezebel. Now those are the Gentile rulers that turn on her. There's a brief triumph. There's a brief period of glory. But then I think she's swept under and she's gone. Well, we'll see. You know, we just keep our glasses focused on the future and see what happens as the future becomes present.
But David, is that going to be... You see that really in the first part of the kingdom, after Armageddon, is that correct?
You mean the destruction of Jezebel?
Right.
I actually do. You are correct.
Yeah, okay.
You
yeah,
are correct.
Just...
You are correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. He knows that my view happens to be that, in fact, the destruction of great Christendom really happens at the first part of the kingdom rather than immediately before that. Now, why do I say that?
Elisha. There's the picture of Elisha with the two bears mauling the 42 youths.
Okay. And the ancient worthies are back by the time.
What's that?
And the ancient worthies are back. Elisha's
right.
There.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
Now, you remember yesterday we stressed that in the seventh plague, there are three parts to it. You know, I've sometimes said the seventh plague is Armageddon, but my brother tells me, well, it's not precise, and he's right. It's not precise, it's really not correct. Armageddon is the battle. The seventh plague has the battle, then the earthquake, then the plague of hail. Three parts to it. The earthquake comes after the battle. Where are the ancient worthies resurrected? At the time of the battle. Micah 5:5. We'll raise seven shepherds, the intervention of the church beyond the veil, and eight princes of men, the ancient worthies, to lead Israel to victory. And I think the ancient worthies are back by then. The earthquake comes after that. In the aftermath of the collapse of their invasion, then the earthquake takes place, and I think Great Babylon falls then. And if the ancient worthies are already back, then we've gone into the kingdom already. I think so. Now, also, you can compare Genesis, is it chapter 18 or 19? I always forget. Where Sodom is destroyed. Let's just go back there, just real quick. Pick up a thought there. Genesis... verse 22, let's start. This is where Lot is being drawn out of Sodom. This is Genesis 19, verse 22. Lot's being pulled out of Sodom. One of the brethren sometimes say, Lot is a picture of the great company. Pulled out at the last moment, those that are still back in Babylon. Pulled out at the last moment, I think that's correct. And now the angel says something in verse 22 to Lot. And let's see, Rebecca, could you just read that for us? Verse 22. We get a taste of this lovely Australian dialect.
Have her read the next three chapters.
Next three chapters? Okay, let's read verses 22 down through 25 at least.
But flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it. That is why the town was called Zoar. By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, including all those living in the cities, and also the vegetation in the land.
Okay, now the point I want to focus on is verse 23. The sun was risen upon the earth when the Lord rained down fire upon Sodom. And this is consistent with placing the destruction of Christendom after the ancient worthies are back. Because they come back in the battle, the earthquake that brings Babylon down comes after that. Now, I didn't mention this point, but in Revelation, what it says about the earthquake, the great earthquake, it says, the city was divided into three parts. Now, what are those three parts that in the earthquake, it's broken into three parts? Those three parts of Christendom, what would that be, Gloria? Just put you on the spot, just like
oh,
that.
Yeah.
What happened in Plague 6 before Plague 7? How many parts came together? Three, you know that.
Three.
That's it. They colluded. They came together. And now that coalition is not going to stand, and that's broken. I think those are the three parts. And Great Babylon came before God to be remembered and receive the wine of the wrath of fury. So I think there's raining upon Sodom. Sodom in Revelation is a picture of Christendom. It says the two witnesses, the Old and New Testaments, at the time of the French Revolution, they were killed in a place called spiritually Sodom. So Sodom is a picture of Christendom. Go to Jeremiah 50. Sodom is, a Great Babylon is going to be made like Sodom. Babylon and Sodom are connected symbolically. So here, the judgment comes after the sun has risen, after the Son of Righteousness has already taken step one in the kingdom. So I think that is the sequence. Now, there's one more thing on this I'll just add. And that is, well, let's go to this diagram here. We've got the 7 days, our seven stages of the church. Now, and this is 7,000 years for the world of mankind. Now, in the type of the Old Testament about circumcision, cut off the evil flesh, what day was circumcision to be engaged?
Eighth
day. Now, most of the brethren would say, well, that's a nice picture of the fact that after the millennium, the little season, after all, comes after the thousand-year reign of Christ, and it's therefore in the eighth day that the evil flesh will be cut off from the world and there will be cleansed. I think that's right. But now, take the matter from the standpoint of the seven stages of the church. That's for the world. But now, concerning Christendom and the false evil that has grown up in the vine of the earth. Well, they're expunged, they're cleansed, the bad is cut off in the eighth day. There are 7 days of the church is now gone, and it's after the taking of the church that on the eighth day, Christendom is cast off, is cut off. There's the circumcision of Christianity, as it were, on the eighth day. Now remember, the eighth day is sometimes a picture of the kingdom, inasmuch as the 7 days are the church, and then the next day is the kingdom. But with respect to the world, the kingdom is the seventh day. But remember in Leviticus, chapter 8, 7 days of the consecration of the priesthood, and then chapter 9, verse 1, on the eighth day, they're ready to go. Well, we're ready to go in the kingdom, and that's day 8 in this picture. It would be day 7 in this picture. You have to keep the two levels of these days separate. And understand, are we talking about the world? Are we talking about the church? The old creation or the new creation? To get the focus right. So I think circumcision is for them on the eighth day, and it is with respect to Christendom on the eighth day after the church is complete. That's the way it seems to line up. This was a major clarification to me a few years ago. Everything seems to fit well with that. Okay. Let's see. Did we drop a thread of thought? Was there something else hanging? We're going to go back then to Acts 26. And we read through the end of chapter 25. And now you notice it says in verse 25, he himself has appealed to Augustus. Well, Augustus was dead by this time. So Augustus must be a word that really stands for the emperor. And the emperor at this time would be, Nero, wasn't it? Or Claudius? I don't know. I'm out of time sequence here. But it wasn't Augustus Caesar. But Augustus is a title that began to be used for the Roman emperor. Okay, chapter 26. Let's read down through verse 5. 26, 1 through 5. Brother Paul, would you read that for us? 26, 1 through 5.
Uh, 26:1-5?
Yes.
Okay. Then Agrippa said to Paul, you have permission to speak for yourself. So Paul motioned with his hand and began his defense. King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defense against all the accusations of the Jews, and especially so because you are well acquainted with all the Jewish customs and controversies. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. The Jews all know the way I have lived, ever since I was a child, from the beginning of my life in my own country, and also in Jerusalem. They have known me for a long time, and can testify, if they are willing, that according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived as a Pharisee.
I find this an interesting testimony. Paul basically says, I'm well known to these people. They know my history. They know I was, you know, pretty high rank at the beginning. They know I defected to Christianity. They know they hate me, but they know that I've lived a good life. He was a well-known person. And, you know, I kind of think the same thing could be said about Pastor Russell. He was a well-known figure. From the very earliest, they knew him as an honorable, good, decent person. Really, nobody had any accusation of real merit against him for anything in his personal life, and except that maybe they could say he's too absorbed with his work, but that's called consecration and devotion. And I think he's lived right according to the religion of the gospel all his life. And he says anybody can really see that that's true. So what these charges, they're superfluous. And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise God made unto our fathers. And whatever accusations against Brother Russell come, that's really the point. He stood in jeopardy because he stood for the hope that we've all had in the fathers of the Christian faith. And now we're coming to a climax of them. We're coming to a beautiful unfolding of the divine plan. That's why I'm here. That's why, Paul says, that's why Brother Russell, I think, was under accusation, under conflict. And now in our day, later in the harvest, that's why we would not have our testimony appreciated, because we're standing really for what's right and the divine plan as we know it. Okay, verses, let's see. Now, thank you for coming, but I don't know your name. Would you?
Patricia.
And Kenneth.
And Kenneth. Okay, thank you. Patricia, would you be able to read for us in chapter 26, starting with verse 7, down through verse 10, 7 through 10. Kenneth, I'm ready to guess who you might be related to, Kenneth, but do you have a relationship that I might know in the truth?
No.
Okay. Then I won't make that guess. I would have been wrong.
Pat's a friend of Shane, just so everybody knows. Pat's a friend of Shane at school.
Okay,
so I know Pat and Ken from...
Okay, thank you. I'm glad to have a connection. Thank you.
Starting at verse 6.
Yes, let's just start at verse 7 and go through verse 10.
Okay. Unto which promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God, day and night, hope to come for which hope's sake. King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews. Why should it be a thought, a thing incredible with you, that God should raise the dead? I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth, which thing I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints did I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests, and they were put to death. I gave my voice against them.
Well, this is interesting. When they were put to death, you know, we all know about Stephen. And we know that Paul was complicit by his attendants, at least. He held the coats of them that did. He didn't throw the stones himself. I think he's probably ever so happy he didn't throw the stones himself. But he seemed to be complicit, at least in spirit, with others. Now, this surprises me a little bit, but that's what he does. Them, plural, not just him, Stephen. So I guess there were other experiences we didn't know as much about. I punished them oft in every synagogue and compelled them to blaspheme and be exceedingly mad against them. I persecuted them. Okay, now verse Kenneth, would you start with verse 12 and go through verse 18, if you would.
Okay. Whereupon, as I went to Damascus with authority and commission from the chief priest, at midday, O king, I saw in the way a light from heaven, above the brightness of the sun, shining around me, about, and them which joined with me. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me, and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecute me? It is hard for me to kick against the pricks. And I said, Who art thou, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus, to whom ye persecute. But rise and stand among thy feet. For I have appeared unto thee for this purpose, to make thee a minister and witness both to these things which thou hast seen, and to those things which I will which will appear unto thee, delivering thee from the people and from the Gentiles, unto whom now I send thee, to open their eyes, and to turn them from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan unto God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance amongst them which are sanctified by faith that is in me.
Okay, thank you. Now, just a little detail in verse 13. What time was it that Paul received his conversion? Midday. Not midnight. You know, a lot of midnights. This is midday. What time is that? Sure.
It's halfway between the 9 a.m. of the Jews and the 3 p.m. of the Gentiles. That was shown earlier.
That's right. That is. That's right. Now, Jesus was put on the cross at 9 a.m. He was killed, died at 3 p.m. That we've covered. First pertains to the Jews because he's put on the cross. Second pertains to all of us because he had to die. Was there anything in Jesus' experience on the cross that happened at noon? I heard it.
Darkness.
The darkness at noon. And I think that shows that at the zenith of the opportunity for Israel, their mind was darkened because they refused the advantages that they had. So now, at noon, Paul comes into focus. So the elect received it. You know, the most were blinded, but the elect has received it. It's right at the time when most were darkened, that's the time when Paul was enlightened. It's, I think, not coincidental. Now, if there's a prophecy, you know, about this that I think way back in the Old Testament that gives some depth to this, it's in the book of Amos. And I think it's Amos 8:9 or 9:8. Let's see. Where it talks about darkening the sky at noon. Here it is. Amos 8, verse 9. 8 verse 9. Yep. And this is a prophecy against the 10-tribe kingdom of Samaria in Israel. And it says this is a little foregleam of the judgment that's going to come. Verse 9 of chapter 8. And Brother Bill Dutka, could you read that for us?
Okay, Amos 8 verse 9. And it came, and it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord God, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in the clear day.
Okay, now let's see how this was fulfilled literally at the time of the prophet's day. Now this is against the 10-tribe kingdom of Samaria, and we happen to know when that 10-tribe kingdom fell. Now you won't find this in the reprints or volumes or anything else, but you'll find that in the scriptures it says the kingdom of Samaria was invaded by Shalmaneser. It gives the name of the king. And you go to the records of Assyria and it says, yeah, for 3 years we sieged this city somewhere, and my chief accomplishment in my 5 years of reign was to destroy Samaria. So we know we've got a good connection here. But you, from the Assyrian records, you can date this. That fourth year of Shalmaneser was in the year 723 B.C. That's when the kingdom of Samaria was overwhelmed by the kingdom of Assyria. And that's the judgment that he's talking about, the 10 tribes. Now, of interest to us is that if you go back 40 years from here, you will find an eclipse of the sun that was today well known among historians. They use it to actually, matter of fact, the Assyrian records even tell us about that eclipse. It's so remarkable. And here, Amos is predicting, I think, that very eclipse. He says, I'm going to cause the sun to go down at midday. Well, it doesn't go, you know, like that, it's gone. But I think the eclipse darkened the sun at midday. And that eclipse you can date easily, 763 B.C. So the warning of the coming judgment was the darkening of the sun at noon, and that was 40 years before the destruction of the city of Samaria, or the destruction of their kingdom, fall of Samaria. Now, let's go down to our Lord's Day, because there we have also... Go ahead, Dave.
That eclipse that happened right at noon on that time? Or
the fact of the matter is, I've actually gone to an astronomy program, you know, and to try to figure it out, and I can't really be sure that I can tack it down to exactly noon.
Because it would only be noon at a particular point, geographical point.
That's correct. That's correct. And more work to be done on that. Let's just put it that way. More work to be done on that. But the eclipse is a spectacular eclipse in the records. I think it's the one referred to here. It's certainly in the records of Assyria. No question about that. And it was just 40 years before Shalmaneser's last year. And so now let's go to our Lord's Day. Yeah, Brother David, I really wanted to tack that down.
Oh, you did? Okay.
And I wasn't successful.
Okay.
So but I hope that we can get that refined and be able to make a positive declaration on that sometime. Maybe noon in the prophecy just means, a full daylight or something. I don't know.
Okay.
We'll see.
Yeah.
From what I was able to find, it was like a couple hours ahead of that. But it's still in the bright morning, but not quite at noontime.
From where on
it would have been. It would have been noon at some time then, if it was close to noon at.
It would. Sometime, somewhere, it was noon.
Yeah. It's like 5 o'clock somewhere, I know.
And with the scriptures, you find a good point, and you try to tack down the facts, and I'm not quite there yet.
Okay.
But it is true that on our Lord's Day, there was darkness at noon, and that really was noon, we know that. And that was, what year was that? When he was crucified and there was darkness at noon.
33.
So in our Lord's Day, that sign of coming judgment was in 33 A.D. Now, the Jews revolted from Rome. Subsequently, the Romans sent their legions in. They took care of the temple. They fled to Masada. They held out for a while. When did the last stronghold of Masada, when did that fall? What year was that?
73.
That was exactly 40 years later. And I think this prophecy of 40 years of impending matches the circumstance of what happened with our Lord Jesus. And that noontime darkening was not an eclipse, by the way. Can't be possible, because that was at the time of full moon, because it was Passover. And you can't have a solar eclipse at full moon. And, that's so I'm told.
And
it's just
true.
Physical impossibility. Brother Bill?
Is there any significance to the time span between those two dates?
Here and here?
Yeah.
Yes. But I'm not sure.
Another
I know
what study?
It is. No, it's another study, and I don't really have a good answer. I just think that you're right. I think there's some significance. But I don't have it figured out. So I'll say yes, but I can't prove it. But that's the right kind of question to ask. That's the kind of question I ask when I go into Scripture. I say, well, this event seems related to this. I wonder if there's any meaning to the time span between them. It's a fruitful kind of question. Now, to see, we can investigate a little bit here. I may have done this before, and I forget the results. 7, 9, 7, 93, 7, 95. Yeah, I remember that number. I've investigated, but I don't have anything positive to report. But the 40 years here, I think, was a fulfillment of that 40 years of pre-warning of judgment. And now you've got in 1874, you got a 40-year period to the judgment of World War I in 1914, and so forth. But so here at midday, when the Jews were darkened, Paul was enlightened. And I think that's an engaging point of comparison, at least. Okay, let's go back to Acts 26. We read down through verse 18. And now I like this next very short verse, 19. Paul just says to Agrippa, he got this commission. There's no braggadocio here, Paul. He's just saying what really happened. And he says, "Whereupon, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. I just did what I was told to do. And I tried to do it conscientiously. And that's why I'm here." What more can he say? That's really the fact. He tried to do what he could. "I showed first to them at Damascus and then at Jerusalem, through all the coasts of Judea. Then I went to the Gentiles that they should repent and turn to God and do works meet for repentance. For this cause the Jews caught me in the temple and went about to kill me. Having therefore obtained help of God, I continue to this day witnessing to both small and great, saying none other things than those which did the prophets and Moses say should come. That is, that Christ would suffer, that he should be the first and should rise from the dead, and show light unto the people and to the Gentiles. That's what the scriptures say. That's why I'm here. I'm just doing what I'm supposed to be doing." What an eloquent, simple, and brief defense. And he's telling this to Agrippa, because Agrippa, as he says, I know you believe the prophets, Agrippa. You got some background here. You know what's going on in Israel. He couldn't say all this to Festus. Festus doesn't have that background. He says, Agrippa, you know what's going on. And verse 24, as he thus spake for himself, Festus said with a loud voice, you're mad, Paul. See, he's not going to appeal to Festus here. Festus doesn't have it. He says, I'm not mad, O most noble Festus, but I speak the words of truth and soberness. The king knows these things, that is Agrippa, before whom also I'm speaking freely. I am persuaded none of these things are hidden from him. It wasn't done in a quarter. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you believe. And Agrippa says, well, most of you persuade me to become a Christian. Not quite over that hump, though. Not quite. Just almost. Oh, Paul says, I would to God, not only to you, but everybody here, not almost, but altogether, were like me, except, of course, these bonds. When he had thus spoken, the king rose up, the governor and Bernice, and they that sat with him, and they went aside by themselves, and they says, you know, this man has done nothing worthy of death. That's obvious. But Agrippa said to Festus, this man might have been set of liberty if he hadn't appealed to Caesar. But he has. And that was God's way of getting into Rome, where he did say he wanted to go. And where God had said, you're going to, you know, from the very beginning, you will be my witness before kings and princes and rulers. And now he's going to be a witness before the king of Rome himself. So this is all part of providence. Well, that takes us to the end of 26. And we've already gone through 27. So that's as far as I've got to go. So the bill, I didn't know whether you wanted to close or whether you wanted to...
open up for questions.
Okay.
If anybody has questions or comments.
Okay, all right.
It's 2 o'clock. I mean, you want to stay a little bit longer? Take a break, whatever. Open up for questions.
Randy.
Just another thing, too, about that.
Turn that on.
New day.
Exactly.
There's nothing about the new day. At a joint convention we had, Brother Gator talking, it was about that the festival of blessings of Israel will be at noonday. And it's found in Genesis 16, verses 4 and 5. That's a real interesting thing, because that shows that the blessing will go to...
this is in Genesis. What is 16?
4 and 5. And it's Abraham, and it's actually described by the conception by Hagar. And Hagar went in unto Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she was conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. So Hagar then begins to see a blessing developing at that point.
Did you say there was something about noonday?
Noonday. Maybe in the first part. No, it's just a note I have in the corner in the margin. So I'll look at it any further.
Well, I'm interested in your thought.
I have it connected with others' other comments too. I'll show it to you perhaps later.
All right. Maybe there's some other scripture it ties into that speaks about noon, perhaps.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm intrigued by your comment. I'd like to have it fleshed out when you have more detail. Okay. Well, we've gone through a lot. So I'll just summarize it briefly. You know, in the first 12 chapters, let's see, now we have this basic outline here. Oh, that's off. But it's not that important, really. I can just verbalize. But in the first 12 chapters, we have a history of Jesus and the apostles. And it's very easy to remember those 12 chapters, 12 apostles, so there's the history of Jesus and the apostles. And then three missionary tours of three chapters apiece. Kind of easy to keep in mind. 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21. That leads to his capture. And then you have the episode before Felix and then before before Festus. And Felix will be the early harvest and looking forward to impending judgment, and then Festus later on before the dragon, the feast, and the false prophet. And then chapter 27, 28, our voyage through the harvest onward to Rome to see what's going to happen. And most of that deals with the latter part of the harvest where we are, and we're still looking impending toward that. But then in these first 12 chapters, you do find some metaphorical a testimony about how the gospel age is going to open. Jesus said you'd start at Jerusalem and then Judea and Samaria and the uttermost parts of the earth, and that's exactly where you find it. First the testimonies of Jerusalem, then they moved on to Judea when Stephen was stoned and they were scattered abroad, then Samaria in chapter 8, and then the Ethiopian eunuch taking it to the ends of the world. And then you have the persecutions. Stephen was first by the Jewish Sanhedrin in authority, then James by the Romans, and then Peter had those gates swing open. And that's the way it is the first three periods of the church. We're so sorry to see you go, but so thankful you came.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Lord bless you. And so you have the three first periods of the church, persecution by the Jews, persecution by the Romans, and then finally when the gospel begins to open up. So that starts a little bit of our metaphorical, you know, journey through the book of Acts. Then we skip down to 27 and 28 because that's where most of our thoughts really have their depth. And then that's about the harvest and our voyage to Rome. And then we backfilled to the three missionary tours. Three missionary tours. I think the first one, Paul starts off at Seleucia, suggesting the Gentile capital. He goes to Cyprus. It's all the synagogues, showing the first phase of the church where the Jewish Christians are the predominant. Comes to that man, Sergius Paulus, and that's where this Jewish Bar-Jesus is struck with blindness for a season. It's like Israel would be darkened until the end of the age. And then Paul advances on, has great activity up here in the north at Antioch of Pisidia. But then he's got some opposition, he's asked to leave. He goes down to Iconium, Derbe, and Lystra, and that's where things get really difficult. He's stoned and left for dead. Like the fourth church, I know you have a name that you live and you are dead, and that was the terrible persecution under the real dark period of the strong papal church. So they went out hunting down the Waldenses and others and really trying to purge them. He went back, and the next wave of activity would be the Reformation. They started off with a three things they could agree on: no idolatry, respect for the blood atonement, and none of this spiritual fornication like this woman in Revelation 17. And it went over all the old cities with Reformation doctrine, as it were, crossed over into the New World, where you have these various cities showing the influences that we would meet in the period 6 of the church, and then the third wave of activity, the harvest that we've gone through today. That's just a brief summary. Now, maybe I should flip the board. Go back to that other one. Yes, Jerry. Before I flip, you have a question here?
I do.
Yeah.
I was just curious about the 40-year period there between
Yes.
723 and
763. Yeah.
And then 33 and 70.
AD. Yeah.
Do you think that there's a 40-year period that is present day?
I do. I think it takes you from 1874 to 1914. We have a 40-year period. I think that's over now. But the prophecies take you to 1874, beginning of the harvest or the end of the age. And then the prediction was, for all that time, 1914 is going to be a closure. And it was the beginning of the time of trouble. And that was a 40-year period of probation. And you remember, that's exactly the period in the Elijah experience. Elijah went in the strength of the second feeding for 40 days. That 40 days, I think, of 1874 to 1914.
Do you feel like there's any other as contemporary?
40 years?
Now?
If I back up from my favorite date, you know, if I back up 40 years, I don't see a marker there.
No, no.
Let's see. Today's 2010, right?
Yes.
2010, that's 33. So back up 7 years, 2003. I could say something, but no, not credible.
Mark Kokhba, does that come to mind?
No, but I think Bar Kokhba Rebellion in 135 A.D. does have a parallel in 1980 A.D. You know, going back a few decades, you know, some brethren were looking forward to 1980. Pulling a cut on, I was quite interested in the date. Not like I am with my current, you know, interest. Because I realized that was not really established. It was, you know, we'll see what happens. But, you know, nothing happened in 1980, so we just passed that by, right? Years later, I was reading the Bible Student Newsletter, and I thought, oh, something did happen in 1980. That's the year that Menachem Begin says, I don't care what the world thinks, I'm adopting Jerusalem now as the capital of Israel, period. They'd already taken it in 1967, but they got it back firmly in 1980, irrevocably. It's been
annexed.
Annexed, thank you, as part of the state of Israel. 1980, exactly as parallel to the year in which the Bar Kokhba rebellion completely lost Jerusalem, and on pains of death, Jews could not go back into the city. So, you know, I was looking forward to the date. I missed it. It wasn't until years later somebody pointed out that, how about that? You know, so I do think Bar Kokhba rebellion has a meaning, but it doesn't take, at least 40 years, Jerry, I don't see anything in Scripture that's 40 years from the very end. So maybe somebody will find something, but I don't see that. I think the 40 years is early in the harvest to 1914.
Okay, there's a reprint article that bears on it, perhaps, reprint 5958.
Okay.
And it's about Masada.
I don't want that discrediting.
And by the way, Brother David, that
thought about the noon date is found in Amos, the 8th chapter, verse 8.
Okay, thank you. That I know, that, thank you. Okay, now that reprint article you talked about, 5950. That's where he talks about Masada. And you're right. He says, you know, he's looking out, 1916, 2 years after World War I started. And he's going to pass from the scene. He doesn't know that. But he's trying to figure out what's going on. He says, well, I do notice that in 73, Masada fell. And the corollary date, down in our end date, would be 1918. He says, well, we just observe it. You know, we'll see. Now, he's gone. 1918 does come to pass, and that's the end of World War I. And that was the end of the Jewish revolt. So I actually think that was a meaningful date. And I think there are other things that show that date as well. So that's a good thing. So now we go to Acts 27. This is really the forte. This is really what my interest was really piqued, you know, from Brother Luke's talk so long ago. We start off here at Caesarea, come up to Sidon, where there's a beautiful period of fellowship. It was clear sailing up to that point. His prisoner releases him to go have some fellowship with the brethren. That was a beautiful time. That was the first 40 years of the Elijah experience, 40 days rather, on the way to Mount Horeb. At Mount Horeb, Elijah saw the wind, the earthquake, and the fire. So there we set out, we get the winds in two phases, Sea of Cilicia and Sea of Pamphylia. They get to here, 1945, that's where they change ships. 1945, the old kings and countries are gone by World War I and World War II. They sail on slowly many days until this last post at Knidos. They're going to leave the mainland now. That's 1989. Every vestige of the old order, they're kind of leaving. New world order, says Bush and Gorbachev. And they're ready to go right to Rome, but they hit the headwinds. The Islamic problem seems to spring up right about then. And the economic woes and billows buffet them. They barely get by Salmone, billows. Finally get into Fair Haven, and we're not there yet. We haven't passed through all the billows. We're right in here somewhere, and only a little hindsight is going to be able to tell us exactly where. We'll see as time advances. But I think after a few more billows, we're going to come to some stability, but not riches, not the phantom riches, you know, that we thought we had.
Just copper.
That's right, that's Cyprus, copper. That was your point. Crete. Would you say Cyprus was copper or Crete?
I think it's Cyprus.
Well, Cyprus, so that'd be over here. Okay. So they try to launch after the city of Phoenix, that bird that rose from the ashes. Paul says, don't try it. Don't try it. It's not safe out there. And I think that's what the church is going to say. Just be grateful for what you got. Don't try this next move. They ignore Paul. They launch out. They're swept by that Euro-Clidon European problem. And they pass by Clauda, try to regain the ship. Maybe that's where the dragon, the beast, and false prophet of Plague 6 come in. They're swept by that storm for 14 days. A day for a year? I don't know. We'll see when we get there. We'll see. Then we come to the island of Melita. That's where they crash. That's where for 3 months they spend winter time. The winter, as you all know, is the time closing the harvest. That's the final judgments that bring you into the kingdom. From there, they take a new ship under new management, Castor and Pollux. I still like the Bryden, but I can't prove it yet. So we'll stick with the other approach. But it's a good influence anyway, Castor and Pollux. And they sail on, finally to the mainland, finally up to Puteoli, and they go on finally to Rome. And that's where he preaches the kingdom unabated for 2 years, the next age of the Spirit, and that takes you to the end of the kingdom. That's it. And I just delighted to have this other path to compare with the other testimonies. We've got the seven plagues of Revelation. That gives us a history through the harvest. And we've got the Elijah experience. That gives us a history through the harvest. And now we've got something else to compare it to. And maybe there's another testimony somewhere we can bring into focus. I don't know what it would be. But I'm just thrilled to have this come out through Brother Luke and some studies subsequent. Okay. If there's nothing further, I'm going to yield to Brother Bill. Any other comments? Okay. I want to say something official before I leave this official spot. And that is my thanks to Brother Bill and especially to Sister Shana. Even being somewhat ill, she has just performed remarkably. If we were in the practice of giving standing ovations, I think she would have one. Everybody thinks the same way. And I just want to especially thank Sister Shana and Brother Bill for their wonderful Christian hospitality, the expenses, and the time, and the trouble. Thank you.